Okay, if you've been to the last Plugfest, I gave a talk on this as well. And this talk goes and kind of falls into that, still reviewing mostly the existing architecture and what we did, because a lot of people aren't familiar with it still. But then continuing on that and kind of what we've learned hosting this very large SMB share in the cloud. Azure Files it's an SMB share that's in the cloud. The idea is that you can net use it as you would any on-premise SMB share, but it's always available, and it's resilient and durable and scalable, and has supports multiple clients connecting, and they all connect via different shares and all via different front-end nodes, and I'll get into that in a bit. I'm gonna go over the hit, just very quickly touch on the go over some of the history of SMB and the evolution of the protocol, just very quickly, and why we did Azure Files and kind of the scenarios that it unlocks. How we designed it, because it doesn't use a regular file system. It's actually based on a key value store, effectively, more like NoSQL tables underneath. And then finally, to go over like what we learned doing it and what experiences we had actually supporting this since it's been in production. So very quickly, I'm not going to go through all the points here. Many of you are familiar with the history of SMB. It goes back a long, long time, even to DOS, even OS2 LanMan days, way, way back. The key evolution point was in Vista with the transition from SMB1 protocol, which was extremely complex, to the SMB2, which pretty much proxied the NT API over the network. And so it was much more natural for Windows to implement and kind of more rational overall. And just other enhancements allowed multiple commands to be able to be packed on a single packet so that you could get more efficient, less chatty. If you know you have to do several commands in a row, you can actually do them all, pack them into a single command. It's called compounding. And what used to be oplocks, which were quite Byzantine semantics, actually were improved so they matched more the actual caching mechanics on the node itself. So we got much better caching behavior with leases, which are also new in SMB2. And we take advantage of those quite a bit. And then finally, in SMB3, we got support for improved clustering support and include continuous availability, which is where it really starts to shine. And so it becomes like a network share that never goes down and is seamless to the application if there are any sort of failures or network glitches or even node crashes. The idea is that it should be just as reliable as a locally connected disk. A little slower for some things, but we'll get into that too. When we started this, it was interesting. I personally had not worked in SMB before. I'd never actually worked in user mode before. So this is the user mode service of running in Azure. And we had this actually great document, MS SMB2, which we actually were compelled to generate. But in the end, it turned out to be actually very useful because it really does go and lay out the whole protocol. And so things that used to be folklore in the heads of a few people actually got put out in these protocol documents. And they were very useful. They're very just descriptive. They tell you exactly what to do, sometimes not why that's done that way. And that knowing the why can be helpful as well. But just having the what exactly we have to do was extremely useful. It helped guide us and answer questions. So we were very happy to have that in the end. Even though, again, we're kind of compelled to create them, but it was a net positive. Azure Files, though, doesn't actually, it's not based on a file system. Whereas if you're running a Windows server or even a Samba server, there's like a regular file system below it. We don't have that. We have this NoSQL, a collection of NoSQL tables that we use to accomplish the same thing. And it's interesting that this document was actually written talking about object stores. So it was actually very generic, and which actually mapped relatively well for us because that's actually what we had. It was an object store. We didn't have a regular file system. So that worked pretty well. The key thing when I've talked to people about Azure Files is that they assume that we're just running serve2.sys on an Azure node somewhere, and that's not it at all. It's completely nearly from scratch re-implementation of the Azure of the SMB3 protocol using MS SMB2 protocol document. Because in Azure we have the two of the major data types that we have in Azure are Azure Files, which is these NoSQL table, excuse me, Azure Tables, which is a NoSQL tables, and Azure Blobs, which are just basically large data objects that you can put data in and out of. And there's a particular variant of that called Page Blobs, which are a block addressable that we use, and which actually hold the file data, whereas all the Azure Tables hold all the metadata. And because these were already designed to be very scalable and resilient and durable, and failing over if any node that you're talking to crashes or we have to update the software, which we do all the time. So even though you don't know it when you're talking to Azure Files or Azure Tables, which node you're actually talking to is changing all the time, because we have to shut one down because we have to update the software on it, and you just seamlessly fall over to another one and you aren't even aware of it. And so this, by leveraging these parts of Azure, of the Azure infrastructure, we're able to go and generate really high availability and durability, and it's the end result is pretty good. This is where we are currently, and this is all I can publicly announce right now. This is our current support. We have SMB3 support with encryption and persistent handles, and encryption is important if you're accessing Azure files from outside of an Azure VM, so outside the data center, and I'll get into that with a slide. Persistent handles is what allows this continuous availability so that you have seamless failover when individual front-end nodes go down, or not even the node crashing, it's more likely that we've simply had to upgrade the software. So we kill the process running on the node and upgrade it and then restart it. The limits right now is 1 terabyte files and 5 terabyte per share. And this was our starting thing, and we know that some of these things need to be expanded, and we're aware of that. Currently, the 1,000 IOPS limits per share, you get about 60 megabytes per second, typically if you're just one connection reading from one file. But again, you can have lots of nodes from all over the world accessing the same file at the same time, so it scales dramatically. Some NTFS features, again, because we're not based on NTFS, so we had to emulate some of the things. For instance, name streams we don't do. Hard links we don't do yet. So things like that, some of the less requested, less popular features of NTFS we haven't done yet. In most cases, they're really doable. It's just there are only so many hours in the day. And so it's a question of just trying to prioritize which things we want to implement when. We also wanted to have the ability that, and I'll get into the motivation of why we did Azure Files, but the idea that being you have a regular file API, so if you have an existing application that talks to an SMB share, it should just work fine talking to Azure Files. But there's also a big move towards a stateless REST API. And so many people think that's more the future of applications. And we wanted to have it so that, yes, you can move your application and run it directly in Azure Files right away. But over time, if you wanted to migrate that and build a new application using REST, that the actual data movement would be seamless. And so what we allowed is we created a parallel REST interface to the same namespace. And we had the rule that we self-imposed that any file that you could create via SMB, you also had to be able to access via REST. And REST commands are sent over HTTP. And because of that, HTTP has limitations on lengths and character sets that in some cases are more restrictive than SMB. And then SMB in some cases was a little more restrictive than REST. And so effectively the lowest common denominator. And so far, that really hasn't been a problem. Some of our paths, I think right now we're limited to 2,000 characters. And that was somewhat arbitrary because we can't actually predict. Because of HTTP escaping, we can't actually know easily how long we can actually, what the real limit is, so we just were conservative. So far, that really hasn't been a problem because most people are limited by max path anyway, even though these days you don't have to be. But again, this is legacy applications written for, yes. 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 Effectively, what we do, and when someone does like a put or something, yes. Oh, sorry. Repeat the question. Thank you very much. The question was, what do we do if somebody is accessing file over REST, and at the same time, people are accessing the same file over SMB? How do we do all the things like byte range locks, lease breaking, all the things that actually make two SMB clients play well together, so they look like they're talking to kind of a local file? And what we do is for REST, like a REST put, it effectively mimics an open, write, close. So that if there are leases to break, that will happen. If there are byte range locks, then your REST put will fail. So it mimics that under the covers. So you don't actually see that, but so that adds more complexity for us in implementing it. But it makes it so you do have this like seamless access to the namespace from both of these different protocols. There are some slides. Is there a published list of like how we expect people to interact with what's the expected interaction between REST and SMB? And what's supposed to just work in terms of guidance, not really, just if you want to use REST, if you want to use SMB, use SMB. Most people are, it's not so much of a choice for them as they have an existing application, and so they're going to use SMB. If they want to go and migrate it, they're going to slowly migrate over to REST. So it's just whatever the application writer wants to do.
So I'm just going to throw in my experience here, yep, because I've done, let's do SMB with NFS and local files and REST and different cluster file systems and everything else. And I think what I'm hearing, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing from you is that you've got the same problem that any other third-party developer would have, is how do I make SMB work in my particular environment? And that's what you're giving us, is your explanation of how you approach that. Am I right in understanding how you're...
Well, I mean, we implemented SMB on top of something that wasn't a regular file system.
Right, but that's what I mean. A lot of us are doing weird stuff like that too, right?
Yeah, so I mean, it's weird. It's obviously SMB kind of is optimized for NTFS because that's what it was written.
Right, exactly.
Especially SMB 2. But Samba obviously implements it on top of Linux file systems. Doing it on top of a non-file system, I think, is pretty unusual. But
we've done it.
You've done it as well. Okay, so other people have done it as well. But it does work. And again, that documentation does generally talk about object stores, not file systems.
Right.
And so that was actually pretty useful for us. This is just our current, as of yesterday, thanks Pavel, the current Linux support that we have as of right now, in if you're connecting to Azure files, either from a VM on Windows Azure, or if you're running Ubuntu Server 7.02 and have encryption enabled, from on-prem, so you can access it over the internet. Accessing over the internet, we require encryption to be enabled, and there's a slide on that coming up right here. So this is kind of cool. That what it shows is that you basically can have people coming in from an IaaS VM, which is an Azure VM, and just net using that path there, and they come in through a software load balancer, which randomizes which front end they get. So that allows this broad spreading of load, and also a immediate failover in the case of any sort of failure or software update. And then the same way, someone can come in over the internet if port 445 outbound is open, which is sometimes more difficult than it would seem, getting sometimes the powers that be to do that. But then you're able to come in and just net use Azure files from anywhere on the internet. And this was when we finally got encryption done, this was actually a pretty cool scenario, because it's like from home, you have this like file share, this like huge file share accessible from anywhere, home or anywhere in the world. So I didn't create a whole lot of time, unfortunately, I tend to do these ad hoc just because it's kind of how you use regular file share. But if you see here, right now I'm actually giving this talk from, this path. David, go. So this is my Azure file share, and I'm actually giving it. And you see the little tilde file there for the rename stuff.
A quick question. Yeah. Sorry, in your previous slide, you showed the software load balancer.
Yes.
So does that get involved in every operation, or after the session setup is done, the clients talk directly to the front end?
Yeah. So once it's a TCP connection established, everything goes over that connection. It's only during the session setup. And so in our experience, when we looked at it, I don't have the hard numbers in my head, but session setup is pretty rare. I mean, usually people establish a session and then it stays open for a long time, sometimes weeks or months. I mean, interesting problems that we had when we did originally durable handles instead of persistent, and I'll get more into that, where limitations of durable handles meant that it caused problems because people did keep sessions open for so long. Okay, so... again, I'm giving the talk from an Azure share. And I think it will have my credentials cached, so I shouldn't have to provide them. Okay. And so you can just go here. It's basically just, any sort of a regular file share. What's the directory here? IS. And we also did all the change notify stuff, which can be challenging in some cases. So. So we did that, and then it just, you know, it registers all the change notifies. And so it's really basically just like a share, and people have been running lots of applications on it. I wanted to try to like, install all of Office from it or something, but I just, you know, didn't get around to that. But it basically just looks like a regular share. Wrong current slide. So again, because it does just support the regular Win32 or C runtime or whatever fail API, it allows people to just go and basically run an app, especially an application that already was used to running on a local network. And that's one of the things we did learn going on, that, and I'll get into later looking at what we learned over the past year or so, that if you have some applications that you basically ran talking just to locally attached storage, there could be some experience gaps there. But if you're actually used to running it on a local network, you know, on-prem, there will be some performance differences, but basically similar metrics can be applied to both. Again, if you want to use REST, again, I want to go kind of quickly to make sure I have time for some of the stuff we've learned, which is at the end of the talk. We have full support for the normal Azure REST APIs that are supported towards blobs as well. And again, as the question pointed out, we take pains that when puts or gets, anything that would interact with active SMB handles to open files, do the proper operations in terms of breaking leases and file range locks and looking like, and we do that by mimicking like an open read close and such. Azure tables are just simple NoSQL tables, and it's one of the main offerings of Azure Storage. We were able to go and basically have the way, if you've ever implemented in memory a normal file system, you'll have different structures in memory that are all linked together and such that correspond to different parts of things that you're trying to control. And we basically emulated that by having a main table, which is like our file table, which has entries for all files. But then we have things, separate tables for what are the current leases, what are the current byte range locks, and those other ancillary metadata, especially associated with open files. And because Azure Tables allows us to do transactional semantics on both a single table and multiple tables within a partition, and that's an important distinction right now that we're going to delve into more later, we can have this very simple processing of this. It provides the infrastructure that we start a transaction and we do anything we want, make all these changes to all these different tables, and at the end we either commit or abort, and that's it. So we don't actually have to worry about any of the synchronization associated with distributed transactions. So it actually made it relatively simple. These are just, again, some examples of the tables we use. Files have just, it's like any sort of an INO table or MFT in NT, just one row per file, basically. Then we have pages which describe where file data lives, handles, leases, change notify, byte range locks, and a few other more esoteric ones. Namespace requests that make the heaviest use of the tables because they're actually changing things when you're creating a new file. Closes, surprisingly, are actually some of the most expensive operations because all these things are deferred until close in terms of updating timestamps and going and updating file sizes and deleting change notify, pending change notify requests. These things are all deferred until close. So sometimes close can be a very busy operation. Hitting lots of these different tables. But again, it's relatively simple because of this transactional semantics. But read and write actually generally, extending writes are a special case where they have to also change some file attributes. But otherwise, they basically have to look out for byte range locks and potentially deal with leases. But those tend to be much, much smaller footprint in terms of only accessing effectively the file table and then the page table to find out where the data actually lives. So I wanted to go into just conceptually so that you can get an idea like nuts and bolts how this is actually implemented because it might help kind of understand it a little bit better. These front-end nodes are the actual physical computers that when you establish a connection to Azure Files, that's who you're connected to for a given session is one of these nodes. A back-end table node is actually holds currently the owner at any given time of of a particular share. And again, right now the granularity is on a share. And that ownership can change if for some reason we have to go and update software. That ownership of that share bounces around on other nodes. And then the actual data is stored on what are called these EN nodes, and those are spread around. So one share will have data spread on many different EN nodes, and those are all going a little bit into Azure architecture. Those are all replicated three times across multiple fault domains and update domains within an Azure data center. So we don't never act a write until we've durably committed any modified data to three different nodes spread around the data center. That should never all be down at the same time, only one at a time. Are they connected using InfiniBand? Not right now for Azure Files. I don't know how much is public, but obviously for other services, we're working on you know technology like RDMA to go and basically make it much faster. But you're obviously talking on-prem. You know, getting RDMA over the internet is going to be much harder. but that's maybe we'll get there someday. I want RDMA to my home. That would be great. So this gives you an idea of how these, and also another thing is too, I wrote these all as front end nodes, as individual nodes, these might share. So in other words, a particular machine is a particular cluster is a collection of machines, and any machine isn't running just a front end node and just a particular EN node. They're running multiple copies. So that these things are all like in a big web, effectively. So the key here is that we wanted to go and take state and try to tier it based on how what the durability requirements for that were. And so, for instance, when you have an open connection, there's things about that connection like the socket, the port number, that only matter to that particular connection. So there's no point persisting that. That can just be held in memory on the front end node. Whereas other and some things that you can cache on the front end, like a file ID or whether or not something is a directory or not. That can't change, it's immutable. So again, you can cache that on the front end node if you want. Other state has to be durable if either your connection goes down or that front end node's died or something, so that when you fail over to a different front end node, all of your existing handles, all of your existing state, basically exactly where you were, is seamlessly reestablished. And so what that means is we actually have to durably commit all that state. Whereas with a regular file server, like running in memory, that is literally all in memory. And you can imagine that things that you can do on a regular file server just by like incrementing an open count in memory, we actually have to durably commit, does incur more latency. But the cool thing about it is that you can basically fail over just totally seamlessly. So one of the key here is that ideally you should try to do fewer creates and closes and more reads and writes, if possible. Because these namespace operations are the expensive ones. And it looks like I actually kind of jumped ahead a little bit. But this is, again, going to how the state is tiered so that we can achieve the optimal balance of both reliability and the ability to fail over, as well as minimizing latency based on what are the requirements for the particular state that we're trying to maintain. And this was one of the cases where we can try to get, right now we have several steps we go in. And by going and trying to create more fine granularity, we can get it even more higher performance. And working on that all the time. Assuming that many of you are familiar with SMB, the idea is it's stateful, it's not like REST. So we have open handles, you have share access you have to worry about, you have byte range locks, you have leases. Leases sometimes are the bane of my existence. So they can be very complicated, all the lease break stuff. This imposes a cost, especially on these namespace operations. Part of SMB3, which was very nice about it, is it was actually designed via continuous availability to actually handle this failover. So the client actually takes a lot of this pain for us by actually remembering things about itself. So when it does reconnect, it provides a lot of information to us. And that makes failing over much easier than if we actually had to try to figure it all out ourselves. So for instance, when a crate comes in, we have a crate GUID. So that if we get another crate, because things could fail at any time, we have to know, make sure that we don't, if it's a destructive crate, to replay it, like it's an overwrite. We have to know that, oh, I already saw this crate and I already processed it. So it's actually very helpful with SMB3 that the client actually does some of this lifting for us. by providing it by basically keeping this in its memory and then sending it back to us. And for those of you who have implemented persistent handles on SMB3, you probably are very familiar with this. This is a view kind of of how it looks on a conceptual level, talking to Azure Files, where you have, again, somebody connected who comes in. There is all the name via DNS. It comes into our load balancer, who then hashes this is when you're establishing connection, who hashes some of the TCP headers and basically randomly selects a front end that way and connects to it. And then the front end that you're talking to for this particular session, so everything for that session goes through that current front end node, which means we don't do multi-channel yet, then goes and talks to the Azure table and blob store to actually do all the reads and writes and opens and closes and all the namespace operations. What the table and blob store is again these NoSQL tables that we use for metadata, and then the actual file data itself is stored in it's referenced by that page table that I showed earlier. But the actual what's called the extreme layer, which is our low level layer, actually stores the data in a page blob. When we were doing this originally, Xtable only supported doing transactional semantics on one particular table. And for Azure Files, we were able to extend that so we can generate a single transaction that performs ACID semantics over a collection of tables that we define. And so for us, those are going to be all the tables that hold the actual handle state for all the files in that particular share. And so that allows us to do, it's not as easy as an in-memory file system where it literally is just memory, but it's not that much harder either. And so that was actually made it a lot easier for us. Okay, this shows what happens when a user is connecting. We have two different clients. One could be in on-prem, a VM, running from a VM in Azure. The other one could be from somebody's home or office or wherever, connected to the same share and potentially reading and writing the same files at the same time. But they all go through different front-end nodes. So that can all be spread. All that load can be spread. And so if the write client there suffers some kind of a loss, so either we're updating the software in this front-end node, which is the most common reason that connections get broken, or a cat trips over your power cord on your router or something, just anything that causes this connection to be disconnected, because of SMB 3.0, the client detects this, and then will go and just seamlessly, without any application required to request or even noticing it, goes and reconnects to that SMB share. That load balancer just selects a different front end randomly based on hashing the TCP headers, and it goes and it connects to a new front end node, and then the client will go and reconnect all those handles. And that's what persistent handles do, is it automatically reconnects them all so that the application isn't even aware that anything happened. And then again goes and starts talking to the Azure table and blob store. And this happens really quickly. I mean, looking at it, it's usually a second or so. I mean, it's pretty fast. Sometimes if you have lots of handles open, that can run on for several seconds, reconnecting all the handles. But again, unless you're actually using that handle, you wouldn't notice it. So if you had an application that was like spinning, doing a whole bunch of work on a handle, and then it faulted over, that you might notice a few seconds of delay. But if you're only intermittently using a handle, you wouldn't notice at all, because by the time you need it again, it's already reconnected. No, durable handles. So the question
was... You're going back to durable handles with 2.1.
Yeah, because nobody uses resilient handles.
That's what I thought. But that would also be 2.0 then, because durable handles were...
2.02. Didn't actually support... 2.02 didn't support leases, only oplocks.
Right.
And we didn't want to do oplocks because they were a dying thing, and they're totally a pain. And without leases or oplocks, the performance implications make it unusable for Azure Files. So we just said, nope, we're going to support 2.1 on.
Gotcha.
And in 2.1, I'll get on this a little. 2.1 only supported durable handles, not persistent.
Right.
And durable handles have limitations that, ironically, we could have worked around, but the protocol, in order to be protocol compliant, we actually had to like purposely cripple our own abilities for durable handles.
That all makes sense to me. Okay, good.
Yeah. But persistent handles are great. And so that allows us to really have the seamless failover.
Goodness.
And these days, Linux supports SMB3 now, and with encryption especially, and persistent handles that supports in Linux. So I don't actually have stats. I was trying to get some stats on how many people are still connected to 2.1, but hopefully not many.
Good enough. Thank you.
And I did repeat the question. Okay. This is some of the, I touched on this earlier, some of this, the example of different states and how we tier them. Again, talking about things that can't change versus ephemeral. The ephemeral state can be stored totally on the front end. Immutable state is a state that can't change, so you can also optionally cache on the front end. Durable state, and I broke up into things called fluid and durable. The idea is fluid is stuff that you can change yourself, like file sizes. There's other things that the application isn't really aware of, things like session IDs, which have to be durable, but the user doesn't really change. So in other words, we know when they're going to change because we're the only ones that change them. So that allows us to optimize that further. And we've got about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to try and go through some of this quickly. Durable handle reconnect, this was in SMB 2.1. This allows you to basically, it was intended to just basically deal with network hiccups. So the idea is the server didn't go down, it just had a network hiccup. And because of that, it imposed certain limitations on you have to have a handle list, byte range locks, break them, and which was unfortunate, but we had to follow that since we're implementing the API as a publicly supported protocol. And it wasn't as great, but it's still, because the user, though, was, when our nodes failed over, because everything is going through a single virtual IP address, the user wasn't aware that the server crashed, so we could actually stretch durable handles and get kind of quasi-persistent effects. Because, again, if the user isn't aware of it, as far as the user is concerned, we're still completely protocol compliant. Because we're doing this all behind the software load balancer. Persistent handles, though, go and basically is the promised land in a way. So we were able to go and it was intended, it was designed to deal with, to provide continuous availability, which is really what we wanted. If you look at the evolution of server, it all started being very primitive. But what you're trying to accomplish here is the idea of proxying the file API across the wire so that as much as you can do, you're making it look like you're talking to a local disk. Now, you have to make compromises versus performance and latency versus reliability and being coherent, and especially cache coherency. But really, you try to tweak all the knobs so you really get that optimal performance. And there's been this evolution over decades, and this is kind of a really big step towards getting to that. Because disks don't really, I mean, they die once every few years, but otherwise, handles never go invalid on them, right? I mean, unless you really do suffer a hard drive crash, and that rarely happens. And we're getting there now with networks, so with SMB3. So that's actually pretty cool, and that's what allows it to seamlessly move these applications, even that are used to running on local file systems, somewhat, depending on how they're written, just to run against Azure files. Okay, so what have we learned? We've been doing this now for a while, and I didn't check with the Guinness Association, but I bet we are actually the world's largest SMB server at this point. We're just, with the number of petabytes and that we have stored, I just wrote this, I didn't actually verify it, but I don't know, if anyone else has a larger SMB server, raise your hand. Okay, there we are. But as I went in previous slides, the metadata operations are especially painful for us, whereas they aren't talking to a normal Windows server. Like if you're opening a file on a normal Windows server and the MFT is in memory, which it will be if you've been opening lots of files and then the directory entries, it really comes in and it finds a few things in memory, increments a few open counts, and boom, you're back. So that a typical open is a sub-millisecond, a few hundred microseconds over the network, if that. And we just can't do that because we have to durably commit 3 copies so that at any time we can reconnect that handle. And we're working on ways to make that faster and faster. There are certain operations that for us are even more expensive than talking to a regular Windows server. When you talk to a regular Windows server, by default, all these metadata operations, even when it has to create a file on the disk, talking to Windows NTFS server, it still is doing it cached. So if you're doing an X copy to a Windows server and you pull the plug on that server, the files that you have when that server comes back up are some subset of the files that you copied, and you don't really know until it comes back up what made it and what didn't. With Azure files, when we ACK that create, it is in the namespace. It is there, durable. When we ACK a write, it is durable. And in SMB 3.0, 1.1.1 maybe they added an ability specifier that we want same thing for writes, but all of our writes are like that. And so for us, that imbues an extra cost that a normal Windows server doesn't have. And there's a really kind of wanky thing with write-only handles are particularly painful for us. If you're talking to over the network, a write-only handle, because you can't trust the person on the other end having to do with local caching, you can't cache it locally. And so every, even small writes, become a network transaction, whereas normally if you have a file open and it's cached on the client, small writes just accumulate on the client and then get flushed over to the server. And so we have applications that go and literally create files, set a file, they don't even set a file size. They do single byte extending writes for like 10 or 20 megabytes. And that's 10 or 20 million write requests. Each one of those single bytes has to be replicated 3 times before we ACK it. And these are very painful. And the problem is the fopen append option is, that's what it does. It opens a write-only handle. So if people are running C runtimes and they do open for append, it's particularly bad for us. And we've looked at solutions to this, like maybe lying and giving them other desired accesses they didn't ask for, because it does speed up performance that much, so much more. And so because of this, applications that if you do this on a regular on locally connected Windows NT disk, yeah, it sucks doing single byte extending writes. But you know, we're clever, so if we see this pattern, it's like, you know, he's done like, you know, a million single byte writes, we're gonna go and just, we extend more. So we basically go and extend, we don't just do extend what you wrote, we actually go and think, you know, they're doing this thing. And we look at the patterns and we try to figure it out, and we optimize it. And that makes these things, while not great on NTFS local disk, it's still, it's pretty good. And so you have an application that kind of, I'll be kind, and had a naive a naive approach to writing to files, and they still, you could get by with it. You wouldn't, but now you run this on Windows and on Azure Files, and you see this huge performance in latency, and therefore decrease in actual performance. And we've had that experience. Some applications. Another thing we've seen, this is one application opens up thousands of directory handles to the same directory, and then putchange notifies them on all. So it opens up, the single application decides to open up several thousand change notify requests, each one on an individual handle, all to the same directory. And so when something changes, we've got to go and find all those and notify all those things, and it can take us more than a minute, and then the SMB connection drops after a minute by default. And so then it reconnects, and we're still busy trying to do all the change notifies, and then all these handles, these thousands of handles, are all trying to reconnect, and we're still trying to do all the change notifies to the old ones. So, yeah, if you're an application, just open one change notify request to a directory, not thousands. This has been a problem for us, and try to do ideally as few opens and closes as possible, and lots of reason writes. Again, another application that we've had, it did 93% of its requests were creates and closes, and only 0.97% of its requests were reads and writes. And this is something which it was passable talking to a local disk, and then they try running it on Azure Files, and it doesn't perform very well. And so this is something we've learned about. Lift and shift, it does depend on the application and the naivete of sometimes people that implemented it. This is interesting. I just pulled this actually yesterday. This is one of our clusters, which are very large, many petabytes, looking at what over the past month, aggregate over the past month, the different breakdown of SMB, specific SMB requests. And there's two interesting metrics to measure this. One is this total request count, and the other one is interesting. It's the aggregation of the total latency of all the particular requests, because this is what the user experiences as pain. You know, this is interesting for us kind of as geeks implementing it, but this is what counts. And when you see this, the interesting thing is what really counts is we have a lot more writes than reads now, probably because we're a new service and everyone's writing data into us, which this makes sense. In a few years, this will probably be more balanced. But read, write, open, and close, in terms of total latency, that's all that really matters. That's like 95%. And then everything else is just noise. So if you have to focus to optimize different paths, and I'm not saying this is every SMB application is going to do this, but this is aggregated over, you know, a cluster, which is, you know, thousands of different accounts doing all sorts of different things. So it's probably a pretty good approximation of what, if you want to talk about your average app. And this is an interesting piece of data that we can actually get because we have so many people connecting to us. reads, writes, creates, and closes are your key things you want to try and improve. These are some resources that you can get. Some of these are kind of old, but they're still generally correct. NTFS feature is not supported. That is updated as things change, and that's still valid today. Somebody asked about that, like things like hard links and name strings you don't support yet. So if your apps depend on those, you know, you could be out of luck. But again, if you're writing apps towards the C runtimes, none of those are supported anyway. And even Win32 apps generally don't use these features. And then as ones become more important, we'll, you know, more asked for, basically, we can implement them. And that's it. So if you have any questions.
So how does it handle cases where people are foolish enough to have geographically dispersed workforces and they're trying to use an application that depends on local network access and is doing things like share mode locks and byte range locks, etc.? Mm-hmm. Having tried to implement something like that in the past, there's a whole bunch of issues that arise, and do you like force these geographically dispersed people to point to the same collection of front ends, or what goes on there?
So first of all, we advise people if they have the ability to run their applications in an Azure VM within the same region as the one that's storing the account. But otherwise, right now, a single account is stored within a single data center. Effectively, we do geo-replication for asynchronous redundancy. But in terms of active, what you're actually reading and writing to, those are all in one data center. So different clients from all over the world, yes, connect to one data center, but we still honor semantically all the breaking of leases and reads and writes semantics. And then even if you're in different data centers, but you're on different VMs inside of data centers, we have very high bandwidth links between our data centers. So even that isn't that bad. But latencies that might be, you know, 5 to 10 milliseconds, if you're lucky, for a crate, can stretch into 20 to 30. And when I looked at somebody complaining about this, who was running an application in an Azure VM in a different part of the country, half the latency was just speed of light. You know, there's nothing we can do about that. And I didn't repeat the question, but maybe my answer is how do you deal with different spread across geographically? Anything else? There's not one right there.
Oh, here, Alexander.
Thanks. My question would be regarding authentication from the client. Do you accept Kerberos and TLMSSP?
Yeah, interesting you'd ask that. There's nothing I can talk about today. However, right now we currently do NTLM v2 authentication with very long keys. I didn't show it when I was connecting because I previously connected, but the key is 128 byte. It's a long key. So it should be pretty resilient to any sort of cracking. I mean, NTLM v2 only does one-way authentication, as you probably know. The server can't authenticate the client. So obviously, seamless integration with Active Directory, which implies Kerberos, is really high on our radar.
Okay. And the encryption at rest?
Encryption at rest, I think it's a GH. So yes, we have encryption at rest. I wasn't sure if it was generally announced yet, but thank you, Rina. So luckily, my PM is in the audience to tell me if things are publicly released yet. Yes, it is.
Anyone else? Oops, sorry, that was loud. Other questions? Going once?
There's still 30 seconds left, I think.
Okay, all right.
Now we're over, but okay, so the last question.
Coming back to these long keys that you say, are they the same for the REST interfaces?
Yeah, it's so when you go to, if you go to Azure Files and you generate a key, you have two keys, and yes, those are the keys we use. So that's a password effectively.
Yeah, so you use the same one regardless which path you take to...
Yes, and what that means is also every user is a super user and every file has the same ACLs. Yes, okay. We know. This is it's not a feature. It was easier. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.